I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Jimmy Kimmel was back on the air Tuesday night after being suspended for comments he made about the murder of Charlie Kirk. In his opening monologue, he was grateful, defiant, funny, apologetic, and emotional, talking about what had happened to him over the last week and what it meant.
This show is not important. What is important is that we get to live in a country that allows us to have a show like this. Yeah. I've had the opportunity to meet and spend time with comedians and talk show hosts from countries like Russia, countries in the Middle East, who tell me they would get thrown in prison for making fun of those in power, and worse than being thrown in prison. They know how lucky we are here. Our freedom to speak is what they admire most about this country. And that's something I'm embarrassed to say I took for granted until they pulled my friend Steven off the air and tried to coerce the affiliates who run our show in the cities that you live in to take my show off the air. That's not legal. That's not American. That is un-American, and it is so dangerous.
Kimmel's suspension has raised a series of important questions about the First Amendment and the right to criticize, even ridicule, the President of the United States. Kimmel quoted a 2022 tweet by Brendan Carr, now chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, who had spearheaded Kimmel's removal.
There was an FCC commissioner back in 2022 who worked under Joe Biden who was spot on. He wrote, President Biden is right. Political satire is one of the oldest and most important forms of free speech. It challenges those in power while using humor to draw more people into the discussion. That's why people in influential positions have always targeted it for censorship.
Today on The Connection, the longstanding fight over words and why they matter, also some of the quirks and nuances, pitfalls and joys of the English language. We asked John McWhorter to join us. He's a linguist at Columbia University. His books include Pronoun Trouble, Nine Nasty Words, and Woke Racism. He writes for The New York Times and has hosted for 9 years a podcast called Lexicon Valley. And John McWhorter, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Well, let's talk about Jimmy Kimmel and his monologue on Tuesday night. Did he meet the moment from your perspective in terms of what he said, how he said it, the words he chose?
He very much did. I mean, obviously what we're seeing is something that involves lowest common denominator thought. And so in a way, although he said it very well, as various people have, I think saying that there's a First Amendment and that what the Trumpians tried to do to Kimmel goes against it is so obvious that we have to pull the camera back and see what's going on. There are people who think that they have found the ultimate solution, and that's clearly true of the MAGA crowd. And we all know that there are people on the left who feel that way too. And so for many people, the idea isn't First Amendment and whether someone has the right to speak. It's whether we have the ultimate truth and therefore can dismiss as unnecessary these other things people say, in the same way that most of us, or I hope all of us, would say we don't need to have a discussion over whether slavery is okay, although sometimes I wonder whether some of the MAGA people might consider that open for discussion. And so what troubles me about this is that absolutist sense of things, because, and this is the thing, when the left think that they have all the answers, if we talk about the excesses of woke in, say, 20 and 21. The thing is, generally, the idea is that you have to do a certain work to understand it, that it's something complex, that it's something subtle, that you have to wrap your mind around it. And I, you know, I'm not going to pretend I have been extremely critical of that realm of the left, but I'm required to make an argument. I have to uncover something. It takes effort. Whereas with this, the wokeness of the right, so to speak, these people are just giving in to their baser impulses. I think the word is basal impulses. It's always what's the easiest thing. I don't like that he criticized me, and so I'm going to ruin his career. That's not hard. And so what we're seeing is a kind of barbarism, and it's really unpleasant to watch how much of an effect it's beginning to have on our regular procedures.
Well, you have the President of the United States on one side. His ability to cancel people, to get people fired, to lose money. I mean, and you've got, as you have written about and talked about, cancel culture on college campuses. I mean, that seems like an unfair fight if it's, you know, kind of lingo a lingo.
Yeah, the scary thing is that, you know, these are the people who hated the cancel culture from the left, and then they're doing the same thing here, again, because they think it's different with us. And we're talking about a kind of power here. It depends on what kind of power interests you. And so I would definitely say that I wrote my book, Woke Racism, because I am an academic. I don't walk around thinking of it this way, but I guess I'm part of the intelligentsia, if you're going to call it that. And I'm a person who's very concerned with the arts. And watching a lot of that being turned upside down in 20 and 21 made me feel like the world was caving in. But I will openly say, and people used to say to me back then, what about what's going on from the right? And that roughly meant, you know, some stuff with Ron DeSantis. It wasn't as bad. Whereas now what's going on is not just what's going to go on in some English department, but what's going on in the whole world and the whole country. And so, yeah, this is a whole different problem. And we're just going to have to see where it goes.
Well, presidents have in the past certainly tried to muzzle the press or control speech. I'm thinking of Nixon's enemies list and all the things that he did when he was president. Johnson and his lies about the Vietnam War. I could go on and on about what presidents have tried to do to control speech and to in a sense, step on our right to be critical and to defy what it is that they want us to do. But it seems that Trump is in a category all to himself. For one thing, he does it out loud. You know, he doesn't sort of hide behind words. He uses those words. How do you see it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the men that you talked about, yeah, they went some places, but exactly, they didn't say it out loud. They knew not to. And more to the point, there was more to them than that. And so with Lyndon Johnson, you know, there's a reason why Robert Caro has written that magnificent series of books, and I hope he gets to finish them, about that man, in that Johnson had an arc. And so he started out with the segregationist views the rural Texan of his time would have had, and he ended up being quite crucial to getting the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. That's an amazing story. Vietnam messed him up, but there was more to him. With Nixon, we tend to think of him as evil because we have such a rich picture of him, partly from the recordings, and because there was just the spectacle of his being impeached and, you know, having to leave office. But the truth is, there was more to Nixon. And so for one thing, he was a rather brilliant politician in general. Trump, everything that's happened to him is just a matter of accident and social media. And he was very much in favor of a universal basic income. He was not the demon that many people think he was. He went some places and got a little megalomaniacal, especially when he was in his cups and he deserved to be chased out. Whereas with Trump, all we see is what he is. And so it's basically that the other men that we saw some flaws. Whereas with Trump, I would have to say, and I don't care if anybody calls me deranged for saying it, I think I'm being empirical, what we see is all there is. There is nothing good. And that's what dismays me so much.
Well, at Charlie Kirk's funeral, his widow forgave the killer. This is something that Jimmy Kimmel mentioned. She said the answer to hate is not hate. And President Trump at that same funeral said, and I'm quoting here, "I hate my opponent and I do not want the best for them." You're shaking your head, but it is shocking to think of the president of the United States saying something at the funeral of a man who was murdered for God knows what, but certainly for some of the things that he believed in.
Absolutely astonishing. And it really shows the moment that we've come to, that he would feel comfortable saying something like that. It's bad enough that he would think it, but a different kind of president would keep that to themselves or only say it in private. But for him to say it for the cameras means that he feels that he's representing a general sentiment. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that he is. And the problem with all of this is that, in a way, from both sides, we're seeing this magnification of hatred. And so from the left, we're taught that words are a kind of violence, which almost invites the idea that physical violence is a worthwhile response to words. And we have unfortunately seen where that has gone. And then to say that you hate your opponent with this stoked up by phones. Where this comes from, and I really think it traces to, and I'm not trying to repeat Jonathan Haidt, but I think that Jonathan Haidt is right on this. It's the phones. It's the fact that the whole world is in our pockets all the time. And so it whips up partisan sentiment, which feels good because that's what our brains are programmed for. And as a result, there's an interesting comparison. Rush Limbaugh, he was public enemy number one from the right, let's call it 30 years ago. A lot of people deeply hated him. Al Franken had a book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot, etc. And yet, you know, the hypotheticals can be risky, but no one was going to shoot him. That was highly unlikely to happen. He did an appearance on a passable sitcom called Hearts Afire that was about a leftist woman, as I seem to recall, and they had a kind of an almost romance. And there was no dogpiling. Nobody tried to pull the show off the air. And he wasn't going to be assassinated. The tenor of our times is such that that kind of thing can happen because of things someone says. Rush Limbaugh said the same sorts of things, but the idea was he's a baddie, but life goes on. We're in a very different point now.
You mentioned phones, but I wonder whether it's larger than that, in that we've got social media, which amplifies, I think, everything. It deals in outrage. Someone with an opinion gets magnified multiple times, and that becomes then the reality, that is in part what we're up against.
Yeah, and what I really mean is social media too, but my point is that we can also access it through our phones. But you're right, if there were no social media and we just had phones all the time and there was something else we were looking at instead, I think we'd be fine. But just think, to use Philadelphia scenery, because for some reason this is exactly what came to my mind despite the fact that I have not lived there for decades.
But you grew up here, so you can claim it. You know, go ahead.
I did. And you're at 30th Street Station. I remember being at 30th Street Station in the 80s and having a magazine or a book in my hand, and it wasn't a partisan magazine, and even if it had been, it wouldn't have the feel of anything Charlie Kirk was saying. Whereas today, if you're at 30th Street Station, everybody's looking at their phone. You have social media 24/7, and that means that people can be whipped up in a way that just would have been harder for all but a fringe kind of personality back in the day. And so I think the phones are the problem because of what you can see in the phones. And so especially since about 2012, when the first generation of freshmen had grown up with the phones. And now here we are.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And we called up John McWhorter to join us this week on The Connection. He's an associate professor of linguistics at Columbia University. He's written, I think, something like, is it 20 books? Did I read that right?
I would have to actually say it's 24.
It's 24 books. Okay. And among those titles are Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever, Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. We have much more to talk about. We began our conversation talking about Jimmy Kimmel being back on the air and what that says about the First Amendment, what that says about speech and language. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with linguist John McWhorter about the power of words, the use and abuse of language. Let me just ask you a couple of more questions about this whole controversy regarding Jimmy Kimmel. The Attorney General Pam Bondi said that she would target protesters who engaged in hate speech. Then a couple of days later, she walked that back, saying hate speech that crosses the line into threats of violence is not protected by the First Amendment. And there's been a lot of back and forth about what the First Amendment protects and what it does not protect. How do you see how it operates?
Well, I'm not an expert, but from what I have been told and what I've read, there is a limit on free speech when it qualifies as harassment, and that, of course, would include violence. In other words, basically common sense. The wisdom of the crowd would say if free speech is legitimately considered to be severely hurting someone emotionally, such as being harassed again and again and again, or the harassment being physically or virtually close to you, etc., then it's no longer free speech. But the idea that you're going to be prosecuted for hateful language, and that coming from the Attorney General, frankly, I don't want to be too too snarky about it, but that just comes from weak thinking, really. That was a really weak moment from someone supposedly trained in the law, and it just shows what Trump ends up making people do, and it's an absolute absurdity. Certainly you can't prosecute people. Thank you. You cannot prosecute people for saying things about someone that you don't like. And that's basically what Trump is directing them to do. And actual grown-ups paying mortgages are going out into the public and announcing these plans. It's a very scary and also sometimes laughable in its way moment.
Well, speaking of laughing, why do you think comedians, and they're not the only ones targeted, obviously, but why do you think people in power will often go after a comedian or a jokester of some, or even a joke? What is it about a joke, or maybe it's the satire, the ridicule, that can get under someone's skin?
Because being laughed at can really get at you in a way that even a direct insult might not. And so, for example, if there's a direct insult, then you can think that's not true because. But if people are laughing at you, and you know that they are, it's this sustained tittering of the diaphragm, it's a complete dismissal, and there's no way to answer it, even if you answer during the laughing. Whether you are witnessing the laughing or not, you know that the laughing will not respond to your attempts at defending yourself. And so what you have is Donald Trump, who is a megalomaniacal narcissist, and so the idea of him being laughed at rather than bowed down to must be particularly difficult to stomach, and therefore he lashes out. The man literally is, and I'm not just saying this recreationally, it's all perfectly understandable. Emotionally, he's 11, except he has the power to destroy lives.
I ran across this several times in actually preparing for this interview with you. And back in, I think it was the 90s, Nat Hentoff wrote a book called Free Speech for Me, But Not for Thee. And a lot of people have been quoting that in the last couple of days. The idea that, you know, free speech is wonderful when I say something, but when you say something, then you must be quiet or take it back or somehow apologize when it's personal. Do you understand that, I guess, the kind of tension of this free speech amendment thing that we have?
Yeah, it's difficult because it's so easy for human groups to think that they finally have the solution. And so that's communism. That is the Cultural Revolution. I do honestly believe that it was high wokeism in 20 and 21. There was a thought that, yes, we can defenestrate people and destroy lives and, you know, submit people to kind of star chamber interrogations without them being able to defend themselves. Yes, it was terrible when that happened to Galileo, but we really do have the real solution. That was very frustrating to see from those people because they were scary and they made a lot of people clam up. We're now seeing the exact same human tendency, except it's in a presidential administration, and that's the scary thing.
This idea of sort of censorship versus cancel culture, that it's sort of an uneven battle as you see it. And you did write that book, Woke Racism, and you were very critical about what was happening on college campuses.
Yeah, you have to be open to other views, and probably we have to be open to the Hegelian way that social history actually progresses. And for someone to just take a sledgehammer to everything and, you know, change what we consider to be standards, change what we consider to be art, just to profoundly transform everything and dismiss the past and to dismiss argumentation, serious argumentation, you never want that. And I certainly didn't want it as something that was supposedly representing justice for people of my color. It stuns me sometimes, and then sometimes it doesn't, that so many people don't understand how condescending a lot of the tenets of, and, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, the tenets of those works are really condescending to Black people. They treat us as children. So that was my hobby horse then. But now we have the same sort of cocksure numbness to evidence, except with even more power behind it than High Woke 2020 had. And that's the problem. Free speech versus censorship, free speech for me and not for you.
It comes
from an excess of certainty.
Well, and you mentioned the fragility part, and I mean, people don't want to feel uncomfortable or somehow unsafe. I mean, that's human nature to want to feel mm-hmm. that you're in a safe environment and what you say will be protected. But but there are, and I'm talking to a Black person, so I don't need to tell you this, there with the history of racism and slavery in this country, it's an uneven, unlevel playing field.
Oh, certainly. It definitely is. And I'm not saying that there is not injustice and that it doesn't need to be addressed, but it has to be addressed with reason. And once it's not being addressed with reason, as opposed to extremely resonant and pretty buzzwords and phrases, then we've gone off on a detour. And that, frankly, can describe today as well.
You mentioned phones and social media, but I wonder whether part of the fallout from that is that we live in our siloed worlds, with our siloed mm-hmm. beliefs, going to places that make us feel as if we're right in our opinion. And we have mm-hmm. maybe, if not lost the ability or the art of having argument, but we just don't know the other side because we don't run into it.
We don't know the other side. And then also religion comes into it, and religion in two senses of it, which is that if your argument, for example, from the tragically assassinated Charlie Kirk, is that trans is, I believe the quote was, a stinking middle finger held up to God. Well, you can't argue with that. I mean, if you're talking about arguing across the divide, right, what you really probably mean is just deciding not to argue at all. There can't be any progress there. And the premise, and folks, I'm not pushing my book Woke Racism, it's now getting old, but the premise of Woke Racism was that the tenets of especially anti-racism that we can remember from that era were a religion in themselves. And many people say I should call it a cult. I find that too abusive. Many people say I should call it an ideology. That makes it sound less pervasive and resistant than it is. It's a religion. I don't think a Martian would notice any difference. And it's a religion that there's some good things about, but it also means that beyond a certain point, if you're talking about race or even gender issues or, Gaza with a person of a certain persuasion, you literally can't have a conversation and it ends in you being called a bad person. That's tough. And so the truth is, it's become something people ask me a lot about, talking across the divide. I think
sure.
many people took woke racism to mean that I had suggestions about that. But the truth is about that little book, what I said at the end of it was there's a certain kind of person who you can't expect to deal with and you just have to retreat. And that's the most constructive thing. And I may lack imagination. I almost certainly do. But frankly, there are times when I'm not sure what we mean by discussion because people who have been in their silos have developed a whole religious perspective on these things, which, if you think about it, I'm going to date myself, but I think you'll be able to follow me in this. Archie Bunker and Maude.
I remember,
in the Family and Maude, and they're arguing about Watergate. And those were some pretty nasty arguments. I almost feel like those were real people, but it wasn't as impossible as now. I remember as a kid listening to people yelling about Nixon in the living room, and I didn't know what they were talking about, but I do know that actually they weren't yelling. And there wasn't this sense that there's this unreachable chasm. And I think that the phones have a lot to do with that.
And the stinking middle finger, there's nothing to be done about that?
I wouldn't know how to reach that. If you're talking about rules that come from certain books, and the idea is that you don't question that, you can't go beyond that. So the only possible dialogue, really, although nobody says it, is that maybe that person will convince you of some of the wisdom of their view. But there's nothing you can convince them of because it's all in this book and you can't go against it. If that's your view of trans, where's the discussion? Mm-hmm. And some people may really feel that there is one, but it certainly leaves me scratching my head. And so my sense is we end up having a chasm and silence and fury rather than being able to bridge that divide. And I hope that doesn't sound facile, but that's why I was frustrated enough to write a book like Woke Racism.
Well,
I had said actually back then I would never write another race book. And then all of a sudden in that summer, I thought, oh God. And that was because of my frustration with this divide.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's John McWhorter. He's an associate professor of linguistics at Columbia University, author of 24 books, including Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever, which I do want to ask you about. And he has mentioned Woke Racism, which is subtitled How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. He also writes the John McWhorter newsletter for The New York Times. Well, let's talk about those nine nasty words. Most we really can't say, obviously, on the radio for all sorts of reasons. But I was thinking of them and saying them to myself and saying them out loud. Why does it feel so good to say the F word, for instance?
Yeah, it's that's probably the best one these days. And there it's been studied.
It's everywhere, I have to say. But no, go ahead.
Yeah, the cognitive scientist Benjamin Bergen has written a book about profanity as well, and he mentions his study, which shows that the curses that catch on the most, or words that are recruited as curses, tend to be one-syllable words with a crisp consonant at the end. And so I think we can say damn and hell. Those two are okay, but they're considerably weakened these days, whereas the F word is that profile. And it's more common today because, and this, that the premise of Nine Nasty Words was that what we were raised to think of as profanity no longer really is. I think you and I are probably the last cohort who grew up being told not to say those words at all.
Absolutely not.
Who didn't grow up in extremely religious or extremely strict households. I said hell once, and my mother literally washed my mouth out with Lifebuoy. But the reason that we hear all of these things today is because profanity is now slurs against people. And so in Nine Nasty Words, I go through the history of everything, including the scatological words and other sex words. But the point of it, I thought, I can't write this and just say cute things about all the things we call bad words. I thought everybody would get weary somewhere around the F word. I thought it needs to make a larger point. And my point was that the words that used to be considered unthinkable, say 75 and maybe 50 years ago, are now just salty. And so that's why President Trump can say to the UN, all of your countries are going to hell. Now we think, oh, that's so tacky. But Dwight D. Eisenhower would never have said that. It would have been like throwing a cherry bomb into the chamber. Whereas today, what even Trump doesn't say, and you know if he doesn't say it, then there must really be something going on. He would never pop off with the N-word. People keep looking for it. I don't think they're ever going to find it. And then there are other words that he wouldn't use, such as slurs that we use against women, and that like the one that begins with P.
He did use the P-word, but yeah.
That's true. I stand corrected on that, like the body part. But I doubt that you would ever hear him using a really powerful word that begins with C that's used with women. Those today are the profane words, as in I don't use them. I believe that with those words, I have never used them in my 59-year-old life. I would be horrified to hear one of my daughters using those words. Whereas, to be quite honest, from the very beginning, I've thought, as soon as they're adolescents, they're going to be cursing like pirates anyway, so let them do it now. And that is exactly what has happened. And so I have always cursed around them all the time, including the F word. And it doesn't hurt anything. They knew that it was my word and not theirs until it was theirs. The 13-year-old is now using it. And, you know, I just figured those are just salty, whereas the big words, the N word, et cetera, absolutely not. No.
Well, one of the things you say in this book is that, and maybe one of the reasons why profanity can feel so good is it activates the right side of the brain.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where creativity and emotions live. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very reinforcing experience.
Yeah, they're not words. I mean, technically they are, but they're generated in a completely different way. Right side of the brain, the feeling side of the brain. What you're doing is ejecting. I'm trying not to use the technical use of ejaculate because I don't think you can really use that gracefully, but I really mean that word. But pushing out the emotion that you're having, and that includes with the slurs, and that's why those words are not always grammatical. For example, if you say, what the hell is that? Imagine parsing that sentence out. What does the, what does the hell mean? That's a funny thing. And that's because it's not really grammar. It's just an ejection that is kind of spat into the middle of a sentence like, what is that? And of course, that also goes for the way you use the F word in the same way. So yeah, they feel good. It's not that you don't have any other way of expressing these things. It's that you're being expressive. And part of how you do it in English is to use one of these little salty chunks. And in a way, that's a good thing. It's you're blowing off steam. Of course, you have to know when it's appropriate.
Sure.
But that's what these words are.
But I wonder whether, if you get so used to saying these words, and the F word being the most obvious, whether it loses its sting or its power or even its ability to feel good.
You know, that's why these words tend to develop add-on versions, and I have to speak carefully.
Yeah.
But for example, with the word that refers to something that might come out of your body, on that one, I'm not sure what we can say.
But no,
there's the word BS, which kind of builds on it. Or for example, with the F word, there is that strange word that begins with mother that builds on it, because you know the F word alone after a while wasn't enough. You can say what the hell. And then you can say what the other thing. Nowadays, people are saying what the and then using the word that begins with S because it's just stronger, because it's newer. So all of these words have a way of building up new versions to strengthen what used to be hot peppers but now has become just lemonade. So yes, that does happen.
Almost up in a break here, but I'm thinking of your daughters who are allowed to curse and not having their mouths washed out with soap as what happened to you. So a decision as a parent to say, I'm going to let this go because I can deal with it. Makes sense.
And I think people should understand that they're 10 and 13. The 10-year-old does not curse. She would consider it inappropriate. She enjoys listening to me do it. And I even dedicated 9 nasty words to that younger one. Because I write there, I can imagine that one day you're going to be the one who uses these words, especially colorfully. But the other one, I would say, it's about last year, where she started popping off with things to a respectable degree around me, because I can hear she's using them all the time with her friends. And frankly, I don't bat an eye. The important thing is that they both knew the appropriateness. It wasn't that they heard me using it and then went into school using the F word. I think we don't give kids enough credit, but I don't mind hearing them use those words.
Well, we're talking with John McWhorter about a whole host of things, including cursing. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, John McWhorter is our guest. He's a linguist at Columbia University. We've been talking about a couple of books that he's written, including Woke Racism, 9 Nasty Words, and Pronoun Trouble. He writes for the New York Times and joins us today on the show to talk about language and why language matters, why it can hurt, why it can help. And picking up on your daughters, and you've written about them for the New York Times, they're tweens or teenagers.
Yeah, they pop up in my stuff a lot lately.
They
That's
do,
true.
Yeah. Well, no, and I appreciate that. I enjoy reading about your kids, but also what they are teaching you about language and new words and how they incorporate new words into their way of speaking. Take us inside their world.
Well, there is a fertile new slang, tween and above. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of it is turning over faster than these things used to. Once again, social media means that everything gets overexposed quickly and also shared more widely.
Right.
And so this summer, you know, we for reasons I won't go into, we spend the summer at a Jewish bungalow colony, just a chance thing. It's the last Dirty Dancing thing that's still standing. And so that's the summer.
Yeah.
And it was really, it wasn't about Jewishness. It was about just that there is a big crowd of tween-aged kids there. And because of the nature of it, I'm around them. Like, I'm sitting on my sun deck. You know, it's a very cozy community. And I just noticed this summer that for the first time, I was Paul Lynde in Bye Bye Birdie, like singing about kids. I really couldn't understand a lot
today,
of what,
right?
what they're saying. That's right. I can barely understand them. And I thought, I get that now, the generation gap. And it was because they had these delightfully nuanced uses of words. And my favorite was the new way of saying hey is to say chat. So chat. I've got this new hairdo or something like that, as if you're addressing an online chat. Apparently, this starts in Twitch.
Oh, wow.
And so then they take it from all online and they actually say it. And it's not something deliberate or stagey. They really do just mumble chat, blah, 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 blah. And that one is also my college students use it. But that one I hadn't heard in use until the summer. And then there was just there's this meme where this rather obese cat is looking at some food that it can't have, and the meme says something like, you can't have it, Biggie, because Biggie. Well, they at the bungalow colony thought that was so funny, and they took Biggie and started using it with themselves. And after about 6 weeks, Biggie just kind of meant dude or yo with a certain affection, whatever the size or shape of anybody was. It was interesting to watch that happen. And now the girls are still saying Biggie here. They called me Biggie sometimes. And so all of that's just kind of churning around. And that means that they've got their own ways of talking, their own ways of using verbs that are sometimes opaque to me. The really big one is giving. And so to say that reminds me of Rodney Dangerfield, or he's reminding me of Rodney Dangerfield, as if they would mention him. But you say he's giving Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh,
giving.
Wow.
And you see, you have to be told what that means. And so that's how the sort of thing that they're doing. And I just thought, and, you know, to be honest, I didn't sit down and think I am going to do the work of chronicling tween slang. It was late in the summer and I was thinking about other things, and I thought, I don't feel like being smart. I'm just going to write about what I know right now. And it was that. And I was glad people seemed to like it, because I was just writing from the heart.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a linguist playground to be able to hang out with tweens and listen to them talk. I love how children, we have grandchildren who are younger, 5 and 8, but you know, hearing them learn to speak English and to put words together and to put funny words together. Our youngest, who's 5, lives in Brooklyn, so he knows the BQE, the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. I'm sure you do as well, John McWhorter.
Caught in traffic on it all.
Indeed. He calls it the Big Kiwi. So now in our family, and you can take this on if you want for yourself, it will always now be the Big Kiwi.
The Big Kiwi. Because he would know what a kiwi was.
He knows a kiwi, but he heard people complaining about the Big Kiwi, and that became the Big Kiwi.
And it is big. That's adorable.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just wonderful how families create their own language for themselves.
Yeah. For you, it'll always be the Big Kiwi, and it won't even be funny. After a while.
Exactly. Which got me thinking about just how when a child learns their first word, just what a moment of celebration that is for a family or for a parent to hear that word come out that has meaning. I mean, it is partly what makes us human beings, this ability to use language that way. I'm assuming that sort of drives you as a linguist?
Acquisition, as we call it, doesn't happen to be my area, but because of that framework, it was certainly something that I was looking at very closely. And I don't think I'm alone in this, much more with the first one than the second, because once the second comes, you've already seen it happen and you're so busy and sleepy with the first. But with the first one, I made a log of what the first words were. And because I'm a linguist, it was less for me the words than the sentences. For me, the magic moment was the first time Dahlia put two words together. And she said, "Mommy, coming," because her mother was out and she was about to come back. And she said, "Mommy, coming." And I thought, oh, my God, her brain is working properly. Human speech, putting a noun and a verb together. So that was just amazing to me, listening to the first sentences.
How do you see AI changing, or maybe Siri, Alexa, you know, hey Siri, how do you see that changing the way we speak?
I don't think it's going to change the way we speak, to be honest, as somebody who's back teaching at Columbia after a year's sabbatical, I think of it as, how's it going to change the way we do homework? It really does completely turn over what it is to do a class. What amazes me about AI is that we are about to be past the idea of teaching ourselves how to speak something on Duolingo, like even to learn halfway how to speak something because you're going to go visit Seoul or you're going to go visit Berlin. It's just not going to be necessary anymore because AI is such that you can just hold up your phones. I've watched it done to an extent already. And of course, you're not going to connect deeply in that way, but it's surely going to get to the point that professional interpreters will be less necessary depending on the event. And it will get to the point that if you go somewhere, you will, you know, if you're on the third episode, the third season of The White Lotus and they're in Thailand and you want to converse with people who don't speak English, the phone will take care of it. And I think that's just magic, although, because I've spent my life since, you know, Philadelphia, as a language nerd, I think it just, I didn't hear many languages growing up in Mount Airy. I didn't hear Spanish or anything, but one day we were on Shelton Avenue and I was coming out of a Yamaha lesson and I heard a little girl speaking what we learned was Hebrew. And to me, that was just, how can a person speak two things?
Oh, wow.
And I get the feeling that my lifelong hobby of trying to teach myself languages, there's not going to be a reason for it. What did I do it all for? But it's really, ultimately, it's a pretty magic thing.
Well, and it's interesting with, you know, Siri and Alexa, how it's possible to converse with them. I mean, all of a sudden, I've done that and then find myself, you know, being kind of smart alecky with her. And I always wondered, like, why are these women? Why, you know, why do we get to boss women around and not men?
Yeah, why is it a female voice? That's very true, because you're going to be telling this person things. You're going to be asking this person things. And I imagine the mostly men who invented this thought that you wouldn't want it to sound like you're in competition with it. I mean, to tell you the truth, Marty, I am not an early adopter. You know, I'm always about 3 years behind. And I must admit, I've never gone into AI. I've never gone into ChatGPT or the equivalent. You can't avoid it now because if you Google, it comes up. I can see what it does, including what it doesn't do well. But I have never had a conversation with a non-person. And I feel like it's partly because I know it was a non-person and therefore wouldn't be pulled in. But there's a part of me that thinks I would, and that it would start distracting me the way doom scrolling on Twitter or X can do that to you. So I haven't gone in there yet. And I say that as a linguist, but I'll cave eventually. But I know everybody else is in there.
Exactly. So. Well, I certainly did. Let me just take advantage of your ability as a linguist to talk a little bit about President Trump and how he uses language. One of the things that he has said is, I have the best words. And he uses caps, as we know, a lot on social media. Mm-hmm. How do you interpret that? I mean, oftentimes caps is someone speaking loudly or maybe even yelling at you. But how do you see his use of caps?
Trump doesn't speak. He punches. He's not getting thoughts across. He's punching you with language. And so it's not a surprise that he's always saying that something is the best ever or the worst that we've ever seen. It's not a surprise that he uses multiple exclamation points or at least one exclamation point, like he's a character in an Archie comic book. You know, do you ever notice in Archie that everything is an exclamation point? He's doing that. And it's punching. And then the capital letters would be predictable. At first, you think, what does he think he's Ben Franklin or something? But it's not that. It's that he wants to punch his thoughts across. And, you know, frankly, I find it rather crude. But then again, think about how 11-year-old boys talk, especially to each other, in exclamation points, trying to top each other. I remember one time, you know, Mount Airy again, saying, well, I went to the eye doctor yesterday and my vision was such and such. And I remember a boy my age saying, well, I went to the doctor yesterday. And if you think about it, no, he didn't. What are the chances of that? Right. And my vision was such and such. And his vision, of course, is better. That's how boys talked to each other. We were both 10. And so that's how Trump talks.
So his vision was 30-30, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, President Trump did change the Department of Defense. Is now the Department of War. Is that just a language thing, or do you think? I mean, how do you interpret what he did?
No, that's water from the same well. And at first, you might think it's something like Robert Moses here in New York calling something the Belt Parkway instead of the Circumnavigatory or something like that. He liked the idea that you had a good Anglo-Saxon name for things. But with Trump, it's more than that. He's punching again. The Department of Defense protects us from attacks from the outside. It doesn't go attacking things itself. Department of War emphasizes that we are fighting. And not to, you know, be repetitious, but once again, that's an 11-year-old up on a hill playing with G.I. Joes. That's the way he thinks. And so it's this aggressiveness of language. He's a very aggressive, and for the sake of himself, but he's a very aggressive megalomaniac. And that's why you have to have the Department of War. I mean, frankly, back when it was the Department of War, we see that as a less mature time in many ways. Theodore Roosevelt was a great man in many ways, but that jingoistic bully charging up the hill aspect of him to basically prove that he was no longer the asthmatic aristocrat that he had grown up as, that is something that we now look back on as rather childish. That's an America with big paws like a puppy, getting used to the idea that it now bestrides the world. Then America becomes more mature in the early 20th century and beyond. And now we're back to somebody who would rather yell charge and run up the hill. Although in his case, of course, he'd have other people run up the hill and yell charge. He wouldn't do it himself the way Roosevelt did.
Well, I'm going to make a weird segue from that to your book, Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us in Seven Little Words, where you talk about the word they, and often used as a sort of gender non-binary person's description of themselves. And I know so many people, myself included, who have gotten tripped up on the they as used in those terms. But you say there's a history here. It isn't actually that complicated.
Mm-mm. They has been used in the singular by people of all levels of education since really the 1400s. You find it in Chaucer. We've always been told not to use singular they, as in tell each student that they can come when they want to. But frankly, we almost all use it in speech. You might avoid it in print, but when you're not deliberating, we use it that way all the time. Even today, you can hear somebody saying, oh, my cousin just got to the airport. And the person with them says, are they okay? That's just very spontaneous. And they don't mean the new they. That's something somebody would have said in 1975. If you don't want to specify the gender, if it's not what you're thinking about, they comes up. Now, the new they, which is Roberta is getting a haircut and they now want a blowout or something like that. Right. I don't know what a blowout is, but I know it's a term. That's the new thing. And it's hard because we didn't grow up using it that way. And just like profanity is not words, in a way, pronouns aren't words. Pronouns are tools, and we use them hundreds of times a day. And there are little traffic cops. And to use something like that in a new way is like, I think in the book I say it's like being told not to use the middle finger on your right hand all day. You know, you can pull it off, but that'd be tough. And so it's hard to use it, but there's no other choice, because I think many people have a dream, and I understand the dream, it's very attractive, that we're going to make up some new pronoun. But that's too hard. You can't just pull the pronoun in all of a sudden, because our habits are too ingrained. It would have to be a pronoun that we already have. And none of the other ones would make sense except for they. Now, to tell the truth, in Pronoun Trouble, I write about they, the new they, as if it was an established thing and we all just have to get used to it. 2 years later, I'm inclined to think that maybe its prevalence circa 2021, maybe that was a sign of those times and it's retreating. I'm seeing it insisted upon much less. It's now often an alternative when a person mentions they. And I don't hear it used as much as I heard it used in 2021. Now, of course, that's me. I live my one little life. Right. But I do live a life where that they usage was the most prevalent. You know, my life is in academia, college campuses, the media. So I'm beginning to think that maybe I was documenting a trend of a time, but I can't know yet. And if it does stick, it's all fine with me, because we can develop new habits. And the kids use they with effortless fluency, which shows that it's not incompatible with human cognition. It's just incompatible with human aging.
Well, we are out of time, and I just have to say I had a grandmother who said thee and thy So just talking about how, no, I'm not kidding. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. John McWhorter, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
My pleasure, Marty. Always here.
And always good to talk about words. And he's Associate Professor of Linguistics at Columbia University. He also writes the John McWhorter newsletter for The New York Times. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. The show is produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.